Would love for you to give an introduction on yourself to our audience, and then we'll take it from there.
Cool. So hey everyone, my name is Josh Liu, one of the founders and the CEO of Seamless MD. Probably my real story starts over 10, maybe 15 years ago. So when I did my undergrad, I didn't know what I, well, I'll back up. I was planning to go into medicine, which I ended up doing, but I think that was largely because that was sort of the traditional path that I had envisioned for myself, having gone through the sciences and all that. But even during undergrad, like I would question whether or not I should do med school in the first place. I remember like one time I was just talking to my dad when I was an undergrad, and I wasn't really enjoying school that much. And I said, "Hey, like, what if I decided to just drop out of school and like go do something totally different?" And he was silent for a minute, and then afterwards he said, "You know what? Whatever you do, I'll support you." And I was like, "Oh my gosh!" Well, that didn't happen. I basically didn't find something better to do during undergrad, so I stayed on the med school path. Did med school, but even then, I was still lost. A lot of my colleagues knew that they wanted to go into family medicine or surgery or something else. I did not have that clarity whatsoever. But I got lucky because I had some fantastic mentors who said, "Hey, Josh, why don't you come spend a summer with us doing research, not on clinical things, but on broader healthcare system challenges around quality and safety and cost." I ended up doing research on preventing readmissions back to hospital. And that got me really energized, I think, for the first time in medical school. And then around that time, and this is kind of back in, let's say, 2011 or so, I started getting interested in tech and startups. I'm not sure why, maybe just random stuff I was seeing on social media, but I ended up actually trying to start a totally different healthcare tech venture with two friends from med school. And we quit slash gave up after 4 to 5 months. And I think one of the big reasons for that was, yeah, we were busy with med school, but we were all clinical people. None of us knew how to write code, build a product, et cetera. So we had overlapping skill sets. And then in my last year of med school, I still had the itch to build something. And on a whim, I applied to the Next 36, which is a startup incubator in Toronto. And what was unique about this incubator at the time, at least, was you didn't enter the incubator with a fully formed team or startup. You actually applied as an individual, and they would connect you with other potential founders. And so I actually met my co-founders through the Next 36, who were both brilliant engineers. We were all interested in healthcare. And I brought the readmissions problem to the team and said, "Hey, like this is a big problem. Could we build tech to better support and manage patients outside the hospital to prevent something like a readmission?" And we launched our current venture, Seamless MD, through that incubator while we were all in our last year of school. Myself, my last year of med school, I graduated, got into residency, but never started it because I ended up going full time on the company. And for the last 12 years, building this company was my it has been my full time job. I actually never started residency, and so. Despite that, though, if not for medical school, I would not be building the venture today. But I hope that gives people at least some a good background to how I got into, healthcare entrepreneurship. But happy to take this conversation wherever you'd like, Rashad.
That's a very interesting choice you made, and one that most people would not make, and one I would probably advise against making for medical students. If a med student came to you and said, "Josh, I have this venture. It's in the current hot thing, AI agents for healthcare space." What advice would you give them, and would you advise them to not pursue residency and pursue their venture instead?
Yeah, I think my advice, eye level, is people should follow their curiosity. So I would say, hey, if you want to go pursue and learn and build something in the AI agent or any other space, you should do that. It doesn't mean you have to leave SCORE training, right? There's no reason why, if you can find the time, you can learn and build and do stuff on the side. Not easy, but certainly possible. And a lot of ventures, as you know, started off as side projects, and it may stay as just a project, or at some point it may make sense because either you want to go bigger and you know you need to give it your full attention and turn it into a full-time venture. Great, you can do that. But I don't think it has to be decided upfront. Is this a full-time venture or nothing? I don't think it's a binary thing. I think you could start as a side project and then decide from there. That would be my advice. Now at the same time though, like I would always, caution potential entrepreneurs, hey, like healthcare is really hard, it's really slow, et cetera, et cetera. And frankly, if telling you that convinces you not to pursue a venture, it probably wasn't going to be the right fit for you anyways. But for the people who hear that and go, yeah, that's fine, I'm going to build it anyways. Okay, then you know what? You're probably meant to build this because it doesn't matter what I say. You're going to just keep going for it anyways, which is fantastic. You should go do it.
How much of your success do you think is luck versus decisions you've made?
I think it's hard to quantify. I think both play a significant role. I think the reality is, when I think about good decisions I've made, probably I would say on average 60% good, 40% bad. And I think it's like you generally need to make more good decisions than bad ones. You generally need to make better decisions for the more important, impactful decisions that you may have. But at the same time though, part of it is just surviving long enough so that way you don't get killed by the bad decisions and you are around enough for the good decisions to pay off. Because a lot of times, like even for good decisions, like luck plays a significant role. I mean, we can talk through many different situations like that. But both play a role. It's hard for me to separate the two and quantify it though.
Talk to me about the best customer you've had, and obviously you don't have to name names, and the worst customer you've had, and were there some signals or signs that this is going to be an easy organization to work with versus a difficult organization, and maybe it's not worth it.
Yeah, so I would say in our experience, and I'm coming from the digital health, so software world, and the answer might be different depending on the product or the venture, but I would say for us, the most difficult customers have been the ones where they've prioritized the research aspect of the innovation over the practical deployment aspect. So for example, we had an organization many years ago where they were bringing Seamless MD in. And normally, when we implement the product, we have a whole implementation and success team that project manages the whole process, that manages the relationship, makes it successful, works closely with the clinical teams and the operational folks. And we run a whole playbook to make it a successful partnership. But this was a case where the health system wanted to run it purely as a research study. They had assigned study coordinators who wanted to control everything, wouldn't let our team be that involved in the process, wouldn't let our team interface with the clinicians after the implementation. And so unsurprisingly, it didn't go very well because, we weren't able to run the playbook. And the reality is, when it comes to healthcare technology, the tech is one thing, but the people and the process and the change management are critical elements where if not done well, the thing could go poorly. If done well, the thing could go great, and we weren't able to impact the people in the process side as much as we normally do. And I think part of that is when folks care too much about the research and not about, hey, how do we make this successful as an initiative in the organization and drive real results? Our best customer partners are the ones who don't really focus on their research and just say, hey, Seamless, you've done this many times before. What do you need to make this successful? And we're willing to invest the people and the resources. So that typically means the leadership team has to be bought in and engaged. People have to show up to regular checkpoints. People have to troubleshoot with us. They have to care about the outcomes. They have to care to monitor the data. And it doesn't mean they never do research, but I would say they tend to focus on, let's make this technology successful And sure, we'll do retrospective analyses to make sure that we're improving outcomes, but that's not the reason why we're doing this. We're doing this with the intent to make it work, not to, hope that it works in a very controlled study setting. Because as you know, the study setting is not at all like the real world setting either, a lot of the time.
Yeah, and I think this has kind of led to extrapolating from the studying and then creating guidelines and different expert advice that states that this is how we should do things. It's led to some distrust of medicine as well, but we'll leave that for a different discussion. Talk to me about your first sale, and how did you approach the organization, and why do you think you were successful? And maybe talk to me about some sales that you weren't successful with, and what could you have changed to close it?
So it's funny when you say first sale, I'm trying to think through my head how I even define that because, I could tell you about like the first few pilots where it's a sale and that it got into the institution, but it wasn't much of a sale if, there really wasn't much of a dollar value attached to it. And as you know, as you get more mature as a company, especially in healthcare, you do less of these pilots or free pilots and more of these actual sales and mature deployments. But I can tell you our very first, implementation at least, which was more like a free pilot, was still a lot of work, right? Like this was back in, let's call it early 2013. We had a prototype, but not much of a product. We had no proof points, no traction, nothing. And I just, cold emailed a couple of surgeons who were doing research actually on preventing readmissions. And people took my call, and we were lucky that we found some early adopters who said, "Oh, this is awesome. Let's try this." Which, by the way, is very different than today, where people get so much email now. As you know, there's so much noise in the inbox that it's very hard to get through to people. Back then, like, you didn't have a million, startups emailing everyone, right? So back then, people got fewer emails. They'd read everything. They'd engage. But it took us 12 months to even just get a free pilot signed with the institution. And it's crazy to me because when I think about how strapped startups are for not just people resources, but money and support, if I were to tell myself back then, hey, it would be 12 months before you got your first user actually trying the product. I don't know if I would have signed up for this, right? That's a crazy amount of time for a startup to get its first user, and not even a paying user, by the way. So I think we were lucky to have been, first time naive entrepreneurs who didn't know any better, because then you can tell yourself, hey, like, it's just around the corner. It's coming anytime now. This is part of the process. I mean, now it would probably drive me crazy that it took 12 months just to get a user. You know what I mean?
And do you find the ecosystem has evolved where now it doesn't take 12 months? And if so, what's changed in the ecosystem?
Yeah, I think probably there's a lot more maturity in just being comfortable with third-party software products. I mean, as especially cloud-based products that are not, installed on premise. Even back in 2012, cloud was not technically new, but I don't think there were that many third-party cloud-based solutions being used at, hospitals and health systems. That was probably part of the challenge, getting people comfortable with that concept. The other challenge we had back then was we were initially back then a mobile-only software product. And back in 2013, only, let's say, 50% of Americans or Canadians had access to a smartphone. And so we had a lot more pushback back then around a mobile-first product. Now we're obviously multi-channel, and now penetration is over 90% for mobile. It's much better. But back then, it just wasn't as accessible a product. So I'm actually looking back, kind of surprised that we even got, anyone working with us. But I can see why, looking back, it wasn't not an obvious solution to have. In fact, if I were working at the hospital, I probably would have pushed back on this product, now that I think about it.
I'm happy not everyone did, and you had some early adopters. One of the hardest things about growing a startup is knowing who to hire and kind of honing down your hiring process. Talk to me about your hiring process, and if you can talk maybe about, the best hire you've had and also a bad hire you had to let go of.
Yeah, so I think one, I'll share a couple of the biggest things I've learned about the hiring process. I think one of the things that ends up being difficult about the hiring process is a lot of the traditional methods, I think, don't very well capture the information we actually need to make a good decision. So, one of the things that you care about as a company is, well, what is that person's actual performance going to be like? And the reality is, an interview helps you assess communication skills, but it doesn't actually assess performance on specific, competencies, right? So interviewing an engineer purely verbally will not tell you much about their ability to code, right? Or, even interviewing a salesperson, yeah, you could see if they had decent communication skills, but that tells you nothing about how would they actually do customer discovery or do a big sales presentation or negotiate something. And so one of the biggest success tools we've used is actually, as part of the hiring process, have the person do some sort of assessment that's reasonably close to the type of work they're doing here and see how they do. So for example, if we're hiring a salesperson, we'll have them we'll actually give them, hey, here's like a scenario, like in advance. We're going to give you a scenario with you work here at Seamless. Here's a hypothetical customer that you're going to meet. Here's their current situation. And you're going to pretend that you're presenting to, the head of surgery and the COO of the hospital and one other person. And we're going to spend 30 minutes with you role playing being a salesperson at Seamless presenting. Us role playing the potential customer and having dialogue about it. And what's powerful about these assignments are that it tells you a lot. So for one is how prepared the person is for that sales presentation tells you a lot about the effort they'll put into anything they do, right? So we've had people who basically showed up like totally unprepared, which is like an indication of like what would happen in real life. We've had others, when I asked them afterwards, like, how many hours did you prepare for this? And one person told me, like, who did a great job, by the way, told me like 10 hours. And that was not a requirement, right? We don't ask people to prepare a certain amount of things. We intentionally don't even give them that much of a guideline around how to prepare, because we want to know what they would do, what kind of initiative and agency they have. And so I'm always surprised by how there are people with fantastic resumes who totally bomb the assignment part, and others who are just like who are early in their career, have less of a track record, but do so much better on this. And we've seen very high correlation between performance on these sort of assessment assignments and actual performance at the company. And I think the other biggest thing we find is that the people who are really good, they can't help but be excellent at any work that they want to output. Like they can't help but do a great job on the presentation. It would kill them to do a bad job. And it shows in the quality of work they even do in this like random assignment in the interview process. I've got more, but I'll stop there. Yeah.
So Seamless MD has a few different products, and reducing readmission rates, it seems like that's a key metric, but you also work with surgeries and post-surgical follow-up. Is everything under the umbrella of reducing readmission rates? And how do you decide what product to focus on first? Is it more of
Yeah,
a
so
customer-led kind of process, or yeah?
we have a single flexible platform that works for many different surgical procedures or health conditions. So we can support anything from like orthopedic surgery to the pregnancy journey to the cancer journey to chronic care and everything in between. And so when we work with the health system, we not only determine, okay, what are the conditions or procedures we cover, but within a specific clinical area, we work with the clinical and operational staff to understand, well, what are the KPIs your program cares about? So it could be the case that, orthopedics in one hospital wants to reduce readmissions. And so we'll kind of configure the workflows and implementation to focus on that. But there's another orthopedic program and a different customer who might say, well, I'm trying to reduce length of stay. And so it's generally the same technical platform. The clinical side gets configured based on the specific specialty, and then the workflows and the implementation approach and how we support them will get further kind of tailored based on what goals they want to achieve. And sometimes it's like, I want to reduce like all of the above, and that happens too.
And it, what was this? So the usual advice is, focus on one specific thing and get really good at that and then expand to, so maybe focus on hip surgery, length of stay, and that's all you do. Don't worry about readmission rates. Don't worry about length of stay for knee surgery or for shoulder surgery or for heart failure or for COPD. Just focus on one thing. It seems like you did follow that advice. And you have been successful, seems like partly because you didn't follow that advice. Tell me about what your thoughts are on, what would have happened if you said, all I'm doing is length of stay for hip replacements.
Yeah, so what's interesting is that we went back and forth on that for many years, right? So we had moments where we said, hey, we should, let's say, only do orthopedics, be world-class orthopedics, get orthopedics in every single institution, let's say in North America, and then from there, then start to expand into cardiovascular, and then get every cardiovascular program using it, and then later expand to women's health, and then basically almost like verticalize each one and then grow horizontally across the health system. We ended up not doing that. We ended up actually going down the whole land and expand route where, hey, like we may start in orthopedics, but we might start in cardiac, or we might start in women's health. And part of the reason for that was it was harder to predict, depending on the health system, what would be the first one or two use cases that they wanted to start with. Now, there tends to be a common set, but it's never just orthopedics. And if we refused to do that and said, no, we're only going to do orthopedics, then we would lose that initial, we'd lose that customer to someone else who was willing to start in cardiac, for example. And so we realized we had to be flexible and broad enough that we could support whatever use cases health systems wanted to go with first. But then the other thing that we uncovered was that health systems over time just want one platform partner for all the conditions because they didn't want a fragmented patient user experience where there could be 100 different point solutions that all look and feel different for the same use case, just in different clinical areas. And so I can tell you, we have some competitors where they're world class at one solution like orthopedics or women's health or cardiology or something. And their struggle has been that, they get pigeonholed into being, well, you're only an orthopedic solution. Our health system needs an enterprise product. And yes, Seamless from orthopedics might only be 80% of what you do in ortho, but Seamless is 80% for every single specialty. I'd rather have that than 100% in ortho and then needing to buy 99 other products. And so once we understood that from the customer perspective, we had a clear path to, okay, we got to be a platform product. We got to support everything, which is not easy. But that's the only path to, winning the long-term partnership and making it manageable for the health system.
Let's go back to your hiring process. I'd love for you to talk me through what it looks like from the idea comes to you where, we need a COO or a CFO, or we need a new sales rep. And I realize there are two different hiring processes. What's the path from that idea in your brain to someone physically working for you?
Yeah, so step one, and I'm annoying about this now, but it's all about whether it's hiring or some other initiative. Is there a problem to actually be solved first and foremost? And then number two, does this solution, which might be hiring someone, actually solve the problem? Because to your example there for sales, right? I think there's often a misconception that the solution to sales is to hire more sales reps. That might be the answer. But it might not be, depending on the root cause of why sales are not growing as quickly as you want. So we can park that conversation because that might be a whole other interesting topic of, when does it make sense to even hire a salesperson? But once you've decided that yes, the right problem to solve the right solution for this problem that exists is to hire someone, then it comes down to, okay, do we actually know the right profile of the right hire for this? And so kind of what I advise folks now is to come up with like a almost like a hiring scorecard for, okay, for this role, like what are the important traits, track record items that the person has to have? And then very importantly, what does success look like 6, 12 months after the hire? Because we have to know what we're hiring for. And then, you know, once you build that out, then you go down to, okay, actually sourcing and bringing the right people into that funnel. But if you don't do that upfront work right, you tend to end up bringing the wrong people into the funnel, and then people have no idea how to screen people properly. And then once you're actually bringing people in, I think a very important thing is realizing that interviewing is a two-way process. So let's say there's a role that I am personally hiring for, and I'm managing the process, I'm taking the first call, et cetera, et cetera. Typically in that first call, I intentionally share a bit about myself and Seamless first. And before even asking them about themselves, I say, hey, you know, like, do you have any questions about, you know, Seamless or the role or anything? I do that for a few reasons. One is I'm putting the effort to sell Seamless first and giving them a chance to get educated. But two is what I found is that there's a very high correlation between the quality of the questions that the candidate asks me and how good of a candidate they are. So our best hires are people where in that first call, like they are grilling me. They are asking me really tough, complicated questions about Seamless. They're like, who are your biggest competitors? Like, how are you differentiated? You know, how are you thinking about your roadmap? You know, tell me more about the market. Like, what's the most difficult part about selling the product right now? Like, they're grilling me, and I love that. I'm like, oh my God, they're intellectually curious. They're smart. They're already thinking about the business, because that shows me the types of, you know, questions and intellectual curiosity they will bring into the team. The lowest performing candidates have been ones who are like, have no questions or asking me things like, oh, so like, is there an office? You know, like super basic things that show no like curiosity about the actual business. And so they don't realize it, but I'm actually evaluating them from the moment they actually start asking me questions, because I found very high signal in that data. And then from there, I start asking them questions. I have a list of like screening questions based on what I'm looking for. But I could tell pretty quickly early on, like based on that, even that first interaction, like how likely it's going to be a good fit, just based on, and I think maybe because we just care about curiosity in our company, but that's a very big signal. And then we have a whole, like, we have a screening process, the assignment. We have like, I can go more in detail if you want. We have interviews with our team members, but I think I would say the first screening conversation and their curiosity, the assignment. And then the last piece I think that's very big is actually the reference calls. And not even necessarily the ones they give you. If you can kind of, as you probably know, like, so you can back channel references and get candid information, or even if it's not back channeled, doing references the right way with the references they give you, that makes all the difference. Because I think what we found is that, what other people tell you about their performance and how they get compared gives you more signal than most of the things they would tell you about themselves in the interview. Because everyone who's reasonably good at interviewing, especially executives, like know the right things to say. Like the people who are executives are so seasoned in an actual conversation that you don't learn that much in the interview, actually, in terms of like the traditional interview. But like, do they show up for the assignment? Like, I'll put executives through an assignment, and some will just like completely implode, or not care and not put any
Yeah,
effort into it. You'd be
I can see
surprised.
that happening. Do you think it would make sense to do the interview last once you've kind of almost made the decision? Because there are people who are very charming, who can charm themselves through an interview, and it's almost as if the interview is just to evaluate to see if you can hold a conversation and have okay communication skills. But as you said, it doesn't. It's not an indicator of performance.
It's
So
fascinating. Yeah, it's fascinating because like if you don't have a traditional interview component where you ask about like their background, their upbringing, like their hobbies, whatever, it kind of feels like you don't care about them on a personal level. But it's interesting because what I've found is that the biggest signal comes from like almost like non-personal things. It's like how they like when they actually do the assignment, or when they ask us about the company, or they give us feedback on what they would do if they worked here. Like all of those have been better signals to us than their hobbies or like, you know, what their upbringing was like and all these other things. I would say the difference is that if they are earlier in their career with not much of a professional track record, then how they did in like school tends to be more useful. But if someone has like a 20-year track record and they're an executive hire, like I don't learn that much from what they did 30 years ago and they're like their whole life story. That's just been our experience though.
So if someone is a has a 30-year track record, how do you evaluate them?
It's all the other things I mentioned. So it's how intellectually curious they are, how good are their questions. The other thing that I do with an executive is I'll actually walk them through. So let's say I was hiring like a, I don't know, a VP of something, right? I would actually walk them through something similar to like an investor deck, which is like here's a deep dive into the company, the market or business model, our biggest challenges. And I'd say, hey, I'm gonna walk you through it, but like please like interrupt, ask questions anytime. I want you to get educated on the real estate of the company and our biggest problems. And same thing, like do they interrupt with like really smart, you know, questions and comments? Because again, if we were collaborating in a real setting, I want to know what our conversation will be like. Are you gonna jump in and actually dig into the details? Or are you just gonna like sit there for like 10 minutes and have no commentary, no questions, nothing? And that's also correlated very well with performance. It's like, yeah, like do they dig in right away? Do they have good feedback on this? Are they thinking about it?
How do you screen? So, say you've put out a job application, or you've asked your friends to recommend people. How do you screen who to take forward from the very initial stage to interviews or these case studies you're doing with them?
So for the first conversation, there's usually just some very basic screening criteria for that role. So that could be as simple as numbers of years of experience in a certain with for like for that specific skill set. So like let's say it was sales. It's like we might just say, I'm making this up, it might be like, oh, you need 5 years of sales experience in healthcare tech or whatever it might be, right? So that's more basic. But I would say when we get to the actual conversation, part of it is just like confirming details about like, okay, like when you say that you were doing sales, like what does that actually mean? Like, were you a BDR versus an account executive versus something else? But if after that first screening call, we're keen and they're still keen, then after that, we typically put them through what I call a skills interview, which depending on the role, this could vary. But let's say for client-facing things like sales, customer success, or something else, it's typically like a 60-minute just a phone call where we'll ask them specific questions about competencies in that role. So for customer success, it might be like, hey, like, you know, imagine you were implementing, you know, a customer here and you were, you know, running a kickoff meeting for implementing that customer. Like, what would be your agenda for that meeting? So there'd be a number of questions to basically find out, okay, do they actually have the basic, you know, competencies for this role? And there's a number of different questions there. One of my biggest signals when doing those skills interviews is actually coming away thinking, okay, like number one, yes, were they able to answer the questions reasonably well? But two is I've always found that our best hires, I would learn something from them in that skills interview. Like they would give me an answer or say something where I'm like, huh, I actually never thought about it that way. Or like, that's a really good idea. It never occurred to me to do it that way. So typically, if I'm learning something from the person, I'm like, oh, that's a really good sign. If they pass that skills interview, then we take them to the actual like assignment, that presentation or something else. And then from there, we put them through a final interview, references. Now, some people actually don't like that. Some people say, wow, there's so many steps in the interview, or like, gosh, I have to do an assignment. That seems like real work. And my answer is like, CMS is not for everyone. But what I tell people is like, look, like, yes, it's a rigorous process. What this means is that if you get through this and you actually want to work here, all your other colleagues here, you know, they're really good because they all had to get through the gauntlet and they're working here now. So like if you want to be working with like really great talent, it takes work to, filter people through that. But that's the opportunity here. And I think what you find is that most high performing people are attracted to that. They're like, oh yeah, like I want to work with like, A plus people who got through this process. Yeah, I'm cool with that. Like, and a lot of people who do really well, they're like, oh yeah, that I actually enjoyed that assignment. Like I didn't find it to be like an annoying thing. It was kind of fun to like put this together and like do a great job and all this. So I think it's just like having clarity around like, okay, like what type of culture do you want to have and what process do you need to build that? And the people who are attracted to that will self-select, and those who don't want to be part of that will self-select out, and that's totally fine.
As you're growing Seamless, how do you think about the decision to raise more rounds, give up more equity versus raising or getting a loan or getting venture debt?
So I mean, regardless of the instrument, like the question is, should I raise, and if so, how much and why? And I think the biggest mistake entrepreneurs make, which is a mistake that I've definitely made too, is and it's gotten better now, of course, with the change in the markets the last few years, but there was just a almost like a momentum to just raise because you're supposed to and everyone else is. And the thinking I've come around to is, well, if I'm going to raise, I need to have a very clear idea that raising solves the problems that need to be solved, because the reality is money does not solve every single problem possible. So a very common issue entrepreneurs run into is I need to grow faster. So I need to raise capital and hire a lot more sales and marketing, et cetera, people. But here's the reality for, some companies who don't have real product market fit yet. Hiring more people does not solve product market fit issues, right? Like hiring salespeople does not create demand. Salespeople can convert demand into sales, but if you don't have enough demand for your product, enough leads coming into the company, like your salespeople will just be waiting for opportunities. And so I think what I found is, okay, are you crystal clear on the problems, the biggest problems you have to solve to grow? And does money solve that? Because if the answer is no, actually, I have to fix product market fit before I can invest in growth, then fix that first. And the answer to that is probably not money. It's actually probably potentially even becoming a smaller company and figuring out why you don't have product market fit and getting that first. And I think there were a lot of companies who unfortunately thought, money would solve product market fit problems, and it does not. That's probably the biggest challenge, especially companies in healthcare face.
When did you achieve product market fit, and how did you know?
Gosh, part of the challenge of product market fit is that it changes too, right? Like you can have product market fit with a specific subset of the market and then reach a plateau and then need to refine product market fit. So it's almost like a never-ending question, because depending on the size and state of the company, you can gain and you can lose product market fit. I would say probably the first time we had real product market fit, where, if you listen to the original like market, I think it was Marc Andreessen description, which is like you feel like your product is just being pulled by the market, like you're getting requests all the time, like it's hard to keep up with demand, all that. First time we really felt something like that actually was probably around, 2021 or so. So this is like, 8, 9 years into the company, I'm saying I didn't really feel like I had true product market fit. Yeah, we had customers, right? But it was a grind. And it was really only then when, especially in Canada, where the government started investing more money in digital health, and hospitals were being funded to procure solutions like Seamless MD, that all of a sudden, like people were just coming to us instead of us like knocking on doors. That was the first time I felt like real product market fit. And I was like, oh my gosh, like it's so much easier when you don't have to convince someone to so hard to buy this. But again, like it could be gained and lost. It's not a one time like, oh, you passed go and you're product market fit. Some of the biggest companies in the world have gained and lost product market fit over and over.
Yeah, I think there's lots of examples here, Kodak being a famous one. Talk to me about, there's a philosophy that building a startup is an all-in adventure, is there is no balance that exists in life when you're doing this, and this is kind of all-encompassing. Do you share that philosophy? And if not, how do you find balance in your life while being all in on Seamless.
Yeah, I think what I've come to realize is that the right answer is very personal. So for me, I don't believe in work-life balance, but I believe in work-life harmony. And I think probably a lot of startup founders do. And I think it's because a lot of founders get a lot of both purpose and energy from their startup and their work. And that's true for some people who are not even founders, who just get a lot of energy and purpose from their work and careers. And there's others who get much less energy and purpose from their working careers and get that purpose from other places in life. And there's no right answer, but I think the right answer is very personal in terms of like figure out what's right for you. So for me, it's hard to separate the startup from like my identity and how I spend my time. And that's not me complaining because I get a lot of energy from working on our company. I don't expect everyone in the company to get the same amount of energy and purpose so that they're spending as much time thinking or working on it as me. That wouldn't be a fair expectation. But I'm not like upset about it. I'm not complaining about how much time I spend on it because I actually enjoy and get purpose and energy. And so it works for me. And I think that's true for a lot of founders. But I think the disconnect is when founders don't understand why others don't feel the same way. And when others who aren't founders don't understand why a founder or someone who likes to spend a lot of time working on stuff like enjoys this sort of life. It's just everyone's different, right? We all exist on a spectrum. So I think you just have to just be honest with, okay, what gives you energy? And for me, it's this, right?
We talked previously about the customer-driven path to building your offering when you first started. How do you think about that now, especially as you grow? You know, I'm sure thoughts come like, well, I could build an EMR better than this. So how do you think about what the future holds, and kind of staying within the brand you've built about reducing readmission rates versus branching out into other technical products that the hospital might need?
Yeah, the really tough part about having an existing company and product line is that it is very hard to just branch off and solve completely brand new different problems. It is much easier to solve adjacent problems to your core product and problem space. And so for better or for worse, that's what we focus on. So, you know, we at least for now, like we don't even think about the idea of, hey, could we build a completely new operating system for health systems? Because that would be too much of a brand new problem space than what we're solving today. But we do think a lot about adjacent things. So for example, like right now we focus a lot on patient care journeys going through like a surgery, a cancer journey, or something else. But it's not hard to imagine that we could branch into other non-clinical patient-facing interactions. So at some point, maybe we do get it more into, appointment scheduling, payments, or just anything, any digital interaction with the patient, clinical or not, maybe we get into it at some point. And there's other adjacent things that we can explore. But I think for us, given our size and stage, we're thinking a lot about, okay, like how do we stepwise build out from the core right now? But that's a tough thing, right? Like, yeah, unless you're a huge company, it is very hard to make bets that are not adjacent to kind of what your focus area is. You just don't have the bandwidth to do it.
A question some investors ask founders, which I think is a lazy question, is what if Google did this? Or what if, for our industry, you know, what if Epic did this, or Cerner or Oracle now? What do you think of that question, and how did you answer that question when it was posed to you?
It was funny because that's the alleged reason that we got rejected by YC after our interview, like, almost 10 years ago. They, we had this interview and then we got an email saying, hey, sorry, we didn't accept you. We think the EMR is going to build this. And I was like, that seems like a very non-YC thing to say. Because YC's whole thing is that, like, it's a lazy question to ask. Why won't the incumbent do this? So I thought that was kind of funny. But I think the reality is like, look, the incumbent, whether it's an EMR or someone else, may very well try to build this. They may have some, they may or may not, they may have, but they may have an overlapping product or a plan to. But that's true whether in healthcare or not. And the reality is, and I always tell people the same thing, it sounds easy, but it's hard. It's, is your product going to solve it 10 times better than the incumbent on a dimension that actually matters to the customer? And that might, and that could mean anything. That could be the customer wants this product implemented 10 times faster, or they want 10 times better support, or they want it 10 times cheaper, or some combination of the above. But if you can figure that out and focus on that, you could beat the incumbent largely because the incumbent has so many other things to care about, right? Like you can take a big EMR who has so many other core products, unless you're competing to displace the EMR, it's very hard for them to focus and do your product well. Where startups fail is that they focus on a product that's a nice to have for the customer. And if it's a nice to have, then the customer has no urgency to pick the product that will get to market the fastest or deliver the best value or is the highest performing. Because if it's just a nice to have, they are happy to wait for the incumbent to maybe at some point deliver that same product that could be 10 times worse. But it's, if it's a nice to have, you know, there's just no urgency to buy anyone's product, let alone the startups. So, you know, that, and that happens because in healthcare, there are just a lot of products that can help patients and care teams, which is why we want to build them as entrepreneurs and innovators, but just may not be important enough of a problem that a health system will pay money for tomorrow. And that's the disconnect. That's the weird thing in healthcare. In any other industry, the startup will say, okay, I'm going to pivot to a brand new problem that actually will make money. In healthcare, you're like, no. Like, I really want to solve this problem that is so important for patients. You wouldn't get that in accounting. The entrepreneur would say, no, I'll just move on to construction or some other accounting problem. You know what I mean?
Yeah. If you had to build a direct-to-consumer product, what would you build?
Oh my gosh. I actually would have to think about that because I don't spend that much time thinking about the consumer space. That's a good question. I mean, to be honest, it would probably be something that is very, very disconnected from the traditional healthcare system because I generally believe that clinicians do clinicians things well and the right consumer product that, you know, doesn't impact the clinician patient relationship or the consumer products that will win. But I have to think about that one. Yeah.
If you do raise a next round, a common question from VCs would be around how are you using the latest AI, and how do you think about that? What are your thoughts on AI agents and their place in healthcare, and are you thinking about leveraging them? And if not, why not?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big believer that any tech, AI or not, is just a tool to solve a problem. So investors might not like that, but I would try to figure out what's the problem I'm going to solve and the best solution to that, which may or may not involve AI or agents or any other things. I do think, and I agree that I think AI ex opens up the opportunities for what solutions are possible, and that accelerates a lot of things. So I think that could very well be part of the pitch because it would open up some opportunities and accelerate things that make it a much more attractive startup. I think that's very, very true. And I probably would probably look for ways to apply AI. But I wouldn't say for me it would be necessary to use AI to build a new startup, although I think it would be very likely that we would. I would say for us though, what's interesting is that the lowest hanging, most common use cases for AI in healthcare right now, as you know, are more are less clinical, more back office administrative things that pose less of a safety concern that get more easily approved, et cetera. And so because Seamless is very much in the clinical patient journey space, our customers so far have not been enticed by applying AI to the patient interaction. And so no one's really saying, hey, Seamless, we really want you to have, you know, agents to guide patients through these journeys instead of, you know, using mobile and web today. Now, I do think long term what's going to happen is like there will be some patients who don't like agentic experiences who actually prefer the current version of Seamless, and that's the best way to engage. But there will be some, and maybe it'll be a growing percentage of the population who eventually will want agentic experiences, and we will have to build agents to guide patients through, let's say, a surgery. But I don't think it's going to likely be, agents only, ever, or at least not for a very long time. And so the question is like, well, when's the right time then to introduce things like agents? And I think for us, most likely it will be a stepwise path to getting there, not because we could not just go and build agents, but because I think we want to match the urgency of the market. So building a bunch of agents now that customers won't use is kind of pointless to me. So I think we see some middle ground. So for example, in our product, we have all these clinical pathways and content that have been vetted by the customer and configured by the customer, let's say for heart surgery. And I could see a world where we embed a conversational interface like a chatbot into the product where, it's, let's say, using, retrieval augmented generation, like it's basically trained only on the customer's pathways and clinical content and can answer questions about that with, minimization of hallucinations. So I could see something where it's like, okay, it's not totally like agentic at all. It's just like a, like almost like a custom GPT, if you will, trained on the customer's content that can answer the most common questions, but in a way that clinicians will feel comfortable because it's like, hey, it's only going to produce content that you have vetted that's specific to your care team and institution, but still has that like AI sort of chatbot experience that's kind of cool that you want to do. So I feel like there may be a stepwise function between what we do now and actual agentic experiences. We're still trying to figure out the timing of that and the right, way to do it. But that's why I feel is like probably for us the best way to do it.
Thanks so much for sharing everything, if I'm being frank. And I think founders will learn a lot from this. Any last piece of advice for founders building in healthcare?
No, just don't do it. And if that doesn't stop you, you were meant to do it.
Awesome. Thanks, Josh.